with something woolen flopping out of it onto the floor. I must have left one bin bag unpacked. I drag it out to check the contents. It's full of scarves. Amazing woolen scarves. They're not mine, but the craftsmanship is beautiful. It takes real talent to knit and crochet like this. They should be mine. I'd pay money that I do not have for these scarves. Belatedly, I realise I'm rummaging through what must be Leon's stuff, and something he's keeping under the bed too, so probably doesn't want everyone looking at. I let myself linger over the weave for a second or two longer before I push the bag back to where it came from, careful to leave it how it was. I wonder what the significance of all those scarves is. You don't keep that many handmade scarves for no reason. It occurs to me that Leon could actually be any kind of weird. Keeping scarves isn't in itself weird, but it could be the tip of the iceberg. Plus, there was quite a large number of scarves in there. At least 10. What if he stole them? Shit, what if they are trophies of the women he murdered? Maybe he's a serial killer. A winter-based serial killer who only strikes in scarf weather. I need to call someone. Being alone with the scarves is making me feel genuinely a bit scared and, as a consequence, a bit mad. "What's up?" Rachel says when she answers. "I am worried Leon might be a serial killer," I announce.
"Why, has he tried to kill you or something?"
Rachel sounds a bit distracted. I'm concerned that she's not taking this seriously enough. No, I've not met him yet.
"You've met his girlfriend though, right?"
"Yeah, why?"
"Well, do you think she knows?"
"What?"
"About the murdering."
No, I suppose not. Kay does seem very normal.
"She's a pretty unobservant sort of woman, then. You managed to spot the signs in just one evening alone in his flat. Think how much time she must have spent there and seen the very same signs and not followed them through to their only logical conclusion."
There is a pause. Rachel's point is deceptively simple, but very well made. "You are an excellent friend," I tell her eventually.
"I know. You're welcome. I should go, though. I'm on a date."
"Oh, God, sorry."
"Nah, no worries. He doesn't mind. Do you, Reggie? He says he doesn't mind."
There is a muffled noise at the other end. I suddenly can't help wondering if Rachel currently has Reggie tied to something. "I'll leave you to it," I say. "Love you."
"Love you too, babe." "No, not you, Reggie. Pipe down."
Chapter 8. Hollow-cheeked, tired-eyed Holly looks up at me from bed. Seems littler. In all dimensions, too. Wrists, tufty, growing back hair. Everything but the eyes. She grins at me weakly.
"You were here last weekend."
"In and out. They needed my help. Short-staffed."
"Is it because I asked for you?"
"Absolutely not. You know you're my least favourite patient." Bigger grin.
"Were you having a nice weekend with your girlfriend with the short hair?"
"Yes, actually." Looks decidedly mischievous. Don't want to get hopes up, but she is visibly better. That smile was nowhere to be seen last weekend. Holly says,
"And you had to leave her behind because of me?"
"Short staffing, Holly. Had to leave. Come into work because of short staffing."
"I bet she was annoyed that you like me better than her."
Sosha, the junior doctor, leans in past the curtain to get my attention.
"Leon."
"Back in a sec, homewrecker," I say to Holly. To Sosha. "And?" She breaks into a big, tired smile. Sosha. "Blood's just in. The antibiotics are finally having an effect. Just got off the phone with the Goshmed, Reg. He said, as she's improving, she doesn't need to go back into hospital. Social services are on board with that as well."
"Antibiotics are working?"
"Yep. CRP and white cell count both falling. No more fevers. Lactate normal. OBS all stable." The relief is instant. Nothing quite like that feeling of someone getting better. Good mood glow resulting from Holly's bloods buoys me all the way home. Teens smoking joint on street corner seem positively cherubic. Smelly man on bus removing socks to scratch his feet evokes only genuine sympathy. Even a Londoner's true enemy, the slow-moving tourist, just makes me smile indulgently. Already planning excellent 9 a.m. dinner as I let myself into the flat. The first thing I notice is the smell. It smells womanly.
like spicy incense and flower stalls. The next thing I notice is the sheer quantity of crap in my living room. Enormous heap of books up against breakfast bar. Cow-shaped cushion on sofa. Lava lamp on coffee table. What is this? Is Essex woman holding a jumble sale in our flat? In a slight daze, I go to drop my keys in their usual spot, when not opting for bottom of laundry basket, and find it has been occupied by a money box shaped like Spot the Dog. This is unbelievable. It's like a terrible episode of Changing Rooms. Flat has been redecorated to look immeasurably worse. Can only conclude that she was doing it on purpose. Nobody could be this tasteless accidentally. Rack my brains to remember what Kay actually told me about this woman. She's a book editor? Sounds like profession of reasonable person with taste. Feel fairly certain that Kay made no mention of Essex woman being a bizarre object collector. And yet, I sink into a nearby beanbag and sit for a while. Think of the £350 I would otherwise not have been able to give to Sal this month. Decide that this is not so bad. Beanbag is excellent, for instance. It's patterned with paisley and remarkably comfortable. And lava lamp has comedic value. Who has a lava lamp these days? Notice my sheets hanging off the clothes horse in corner of the room. She's washed them. Irritating, as I went to great lengths to wash those and was late for shift as a result. But must remember that annoying Essex woman does not actually know me. Would not know that I would obviously clean sheets before inviting stranger to sleep in them. Eh? What's the bedroom going to look like? Venture in, intrepid. Let out a strangled wail. It looks like someone vomited rainbows and calico in here, covering every surface in colours that do not belong together in nature. Horrific, moth-eaten blanket over bed, enormous beige sewing machine taking up most of desk, and clothes. Clothes everywhere. This woman owns more clothes than a respectably sized shop would stock. Has clearly not been able to manage with the half of wardrobe I freed up for her, so has hung up dresses on back of door, all along wall, from old picture rail, actually quite resourceful, and over back of now almost invisible chair under window. Consider ringing her and putting foot down for approximately 3 seconds before reaching inevitable conclusion that that would be awkward, and in a few days I will have stopped caring. Probably stopped noticing, actually. Still, right now, opinion of Essex woman has reached new low. I'm about to head back to Spot on very inviting beanbag when I notice the bin bag of scarves Mr. Pryor knitted me, poking out from under bed. Forgot about those. Essex woman may think I'm odd if she finds bag of 14 hand-knitted scarves stashed under bed. I've been meaning to take them to the charity shop forever, but of course, Essex woman won't know that. Haven't actually met her. Don't want her to think I'm, you know, a scarf collector or something. Grab pen and paper and scrawl, "For charity shop," on a post-it, then stick it to the bag. There. Just to remind myself, in case I forget. Now to the beanbag for dinner and bed. So tired that even the horrible tie-dyed bed blanket is beginning to look attractive.
Chapter 9. So, here I am. On the freezing cold dock, in neutral clothing I can work with, according to Catherine, who is beaming cheekily at me, the wind whipping her straw blonde hair against her cheeks as we wait for the cruise ship to batten down the hatch or turn 3 sails to the wind or whatever it is these ships do in order to let people on board. "You have the perfect proportions for this sort of thing," Catherine is telling me. "You're my favourite model, Tiffy. Really, this is going to be an absolute scream." I raise an eyebrow, looking out to sea. I don't see a vast selection of other models for Catherine to choose from. I have also, over the years, got a bit tired of people lauding my proportions. The thing is, I'm like Gertie and Moe's flat in reverse, just about 20% bigger than the average woman in all directions. My mother likes to declare that I am big-boned because my father was a lumberjack in his youth. Was he? I know he's old, but didn't lumberjacks only exist in fairy tales? I can barely walk into a room without someone helpfully informing me that I'm very tall for a woman. Sometimes it annoys people, like I'm purposefully taking up more room than I'm allowed, and sometimes it intimidates them, especially when they're used to looking down at women they're talking to. But mostly it just makes them compliment me on my proportions a lot. I think what they're really saying is, gosh, you're big, but without being particularly fat. Or, well done on being tall, but not lanky. Or perhaps, you are confusing my gender norms by being very woman-shaped despite the fact that you are the height and width of an average male. You're the sort of woman the Soviets liked, Catherine goes on, oblivious to my raised eyebrow. You know, on their posters about women working the land while the men were out fighting, that sort of thing. Wear a lot of crochet, did they, the Soviet women? I ask rather tetchily. It's drizzling, and the sea looks very different from a busy dock like this. It's a lot less glamorous than when you're on the beach. It's basically just a big, cold, salty bath, really. I wonder how warm the rights director is now, in her meeting about the international reach of our spring season titles. Possibly, possibly, Catherine muses. Good idea, Tiffy. What do you think? A chapter on the history of crochet in the next book? No, I tell her firmly. That won't be popular with your readers. You have to nip ideas in the bud fast with Catherine, and I'm definitely right on this one. Nobody wants history. They just want an idea for a new crochet item they can give their grandson to drool on. But I'm just conveying the brutality of the market to you, Catherine, I say. That's one of my favourite lines. Good old market, always there to be blamed. People don't want history in their crochet books. They want cute pictures and easy instructions. Once all our documents have been checked, we file on board. You can't really tell where the dock ends and the boat begins. It's just like walking into a building and developing very slight lightheadedness, as though the floor is shifting a little beneath you. I thought we might get a different, more exciting welcome for being special guests who've been invited here, but we're just traipsing on with the rest of the riffraff, all of whom are at least 20 times richer than me, obviously, and much better dressed. It's actually pretty small for a cruise ship, so only the size of, say, Portsmouth rather than London. We're shuffled politely into a corner of the entertainment area to wait for our cue. We're to set up after the guests have had lunch. Nobody brings us lunch. Catherine, of course, has brought her own sandwiches. They're sardine. She cheerfully offers me half, which is actually very sweet of her, and eventually my stomach rumbling gets so bad that I concede defeat and accept one. I'm twitchy. The last time I was on a cruise, it was through the Greek islands with Justin, and I was positively glowing with love and post-sex hormones. Now, huddled in a corner with three Aldi bags of knitting needles, crochet hooks and wool, accompanied by an ex-hippie and a sardine sandwich, I can no longer deny the fact that my life has taken a turn for the worse. So, what's the plan then? I ask Catherine, nibbling the crusts off the sandwich. The fishiness isn't so bad at the edges. What do I need to do? I'll demonstrate how to take measurements from you first, Catherine says. Then I'll talk through the basic stitches for any beginners. Then I'll use my pre-prepared bits to show them the tricks of compiling yourself a perfectly fitted outfit. And of course, I'll show them my five top tips for measuring as you go. Measuring as you go is one of Catherine's catchphrases. It has yet to catch on. In the end, when it's finally time for us to kick off, we gather quite a crowd. Catherine knows how to do that. She probably practiced at rallies and things back in the days of yore. It's largely a crowd of old ladies and their husbands, but there are a few younger women in their 20s and 30s, and even a couple of guys. I'm quite encouraged. Maybe Catherine's right that crochet is on the up. A big hand for my glamorous assistant, Catherine is saying as though we're putting on a magic show. Actually, the magician in the other corner of the entertainment area is looking pretty miffed. Everyone claps me dutifully. I try to look cheerful and crochet-ish, but I'm still chilly and I feel drab in my neutral clothing. White jeans, pale grey t-shirt, and a lovely warm pink cardigan that I thought I'd sold sometime last year, but rediscovered in my wardrobe this morning. It's the only colourful element to this outfit, and I can tell Catherine is about to... Cardigan off! She says, already undressing me. This is so undignified and cold. Are you all paying close attention? Phones away, please. We managed without checking Facebook every 5 minutes in the Cold War, didn't we? That's right, a bit of perspective for you all. Phones away, that's it. I try not to laugh. That's trademark Catherine. She always says bringing up the Cold War startles people into submission. She starts measuring me. Neck, shoulders, bust, waist, hips. And it occurs to me that my measurements are now being read out to a really quite large group of people, which makes my urge to laugh even more powerful. It's the classic, isn't it? You're not allowed to laugh, and suddenly that's what you want to do more than anything. Catherine shoots me a warning look as she measures my hips, chatting away about pleating to create sufficient room for the buttocks, and no doubt feeling how my body is beginning to shake with suppressed laughter. I know I need to be professional. I know I can't just burst out laughing right now. It'll totally undermine her. But look at me. That old lady over there just wrote down my inner thigh measurement in her notebook. And that guy at the back looks... That guy at the back... That's Justin. He moves away when I clock it to him, slipping off into the crowd. But first, before he goes, he holds my gaze. It sends a shock right through me because it's not your ordinary eye contact. It's a very distinct sort of eye contact. The sort you get locked into in the moment just before you toss a 20 on the table and scramble out of the pub to make out in the cab home, or in the moment when you put down the wine glass and head upstairs to bed. It's sex eye contact. His eyes say, "I'm undressing you in my head." The man who left me months ago, who hasn't picked up one of my calls since, whose fiancée is probably on this very cruise with him, he's giving me that look. And in that moment, I am more exposed than any number of elderly ladies with notebooks could make me feel. I feel completely naked.
Chapter 10. You could have found each other again. Love finds a way, Mr. Pryor. Love finds a way. Mr. Pryor is unconvinced. No offence, lad, but you weren't there. That's not how it worked. Of course there were lovely stories, girls who thought their lads were long dead, then came home to find them traipsing up the path in their uniform, fresh as a daisy. But for everyone, there were hundreds of stories of lovers who never came back. Johnny's probably dead, and if he's not, he's long since married to some gentleman or lady somewhere, and I'm forgotten. But you said he wasn't on that list. I'm waving a hand at the list of war dead I printed, unsure why I'm pushing this point so hard. Mr. Pryor hasn't asked to find Johnny. He was just pining, reminiscing. But I see a lot of elderly people here. I'm used to reminiscing. I'm used to pining. Felt that this was different. I felt Mr. Pryor had unfinished business. I don't think so, no. But then, I'm a forgetful old man. And your computer system is a newfangled thing. So either of us could be wrong, couldn't we? He gives me a gentle smile, like I'm doing this for me, not him. Look closer at him. Think of all the nights when I've arrived to chatter about visitors from other patients, and have seen Mr. Pryor sitting quietly in the corner, hands in his lap, face folded in neat wrinkles, like he's trying hard not to look sad. Humour me. Tell me the facts. Regiment? Birthplace? Distinctive features. Family members. Mr. Pryor's little beady eyes look up at me. He shrugs, smiles. It folds his papery, age-spotted face, shifting the tan lines like ink on his neck, left there from decades of shirt collars of precisely the same width. He gives a slight shake of the head, like he'll tell someone later how barmy these modern nurses are, but starts talking all the same. Thursday morning. Ring ma'am for short, difficult conversation on bus.
Is there news?
This has been customary greeting for months. Sorry, ma'am.
Shall I call Sal?
No, I'm dealing with it. Long, miserable silence. We wallow in it. Then, ma'am says, with effort.
Sorry, sweetheart. How are you?
Return home afterwards to find pleasant surprise. Home-baked flapjack on sideboard. It's filled with colourful dried fruit and seeds, like Essex woman cannot resist clashing colours even in food. But this seems less objectionable when I see the note beside the tray. Help yourself. Hope you had a good day. I mean night. Tiffy, kiss. An excellent development. We'll definitely endure high levels of clutter and novelty lamps for £350 per month and free food. Help myself to large slice and settle down with it to write to Richie, filling him in on Holly's condition. She's knave girl in my letters to him, and a bit of a caricature of herself, sharper, snarkier, cuter. I reach for more flapjack without looking,
filling page two with descriptions of the stranger Essex woman items, some of which are so ridiculous I think Richie won't believe me. An iron in the shape of Iron Man? Actual clown shoes, hung on the wall like a work of art. Cowboy boots with spurs, which I can only conclude she wears regularly, looking at how worn they are. Noticed absently as I fiddle with the stamp that I have eaten four slices of flapjack. Hope she really meant help yourself. While biro is in hand, scribble on back of her note. Thanks. So delicious, I accidentally ate most of it. Pause before finishing the note. Feel I need to repay her on something. There is really hardly any flapjack remaining in the tray. Thanks. So delicious, I accidentally ate most of it. Leftover mushroom stroganoff in fridge if you need dinner, on account of having hardly any flapjack left. Leon. Better make mushroom stroganoff now. That was not the only note left for me this morning. There's this one on the bathroom door. Hi, Leon. Would you mind putting the toilet seat down, please? I'm afraid I was unable to write this note in a way that didn't sound passive-aggressive. Seriously, it's something about the note form. You pick up a pen and post it and you immediately become a bitch. So I'm just styling it out. I might put some smiley faces to really hammer the thing home. Tiffy. Kiss. There are smiley faces all along the bottom of the note. I snort with laughter. One of the smiley faces has a body and is pissing towards the corner of the post-it. Wasn't expecting that. Not sure why. I don't know this woman. But hadn't imagined she had much of a sense of humour. Maybe because all her books are about DIY.
Chapter 11. That is ridiculous. I know, I say. That was it? Rachel yells. I flinch. Last night I drank a bottle of wine, panic-baked flapjack, and barely slept. I'm a little fragile for shouting. We're sitting in the creative space at work. It's like the other two Butterfingers Press meeting rooms, except annoyingly it doesn't have a proper door to convey a sense of openness, and there are whiteboards on the walls. Somebody used them once. Now the notes from their creative session are ingrained in dried-out whiteboard marker, totally incomprehensible. Rachel has printed out the layouts we're meeting to discuss, and they're spread out across the table between us. It's the bloody Make a Stir baking book, and you can really tell I was hungover and in a rush when I edited this the first time around. You're telling me that you see Justin on a cruise ship, and then he gives you a I want to fuck you stare, and then you go on about your business and don't see him again. I know, I say again, positively miserable. Ridiculous! Why didn't you go looking for him? I was busy with Catherine, who, by the way, gave me an actual injury, I tell her, yanking my poncho out of the way to show her the angry red mark where Catherine pretty much stabbed my arm mid-demonstration. Rachel gives it a cursory look. I hope you brought her manuscript delivery date forward for that, she says. Are you sure it was Justin, not some other white guy with brown hair? I mean, I imagine a cruise ship is... Rachel, I know what Justin looks like. Right, well, she says, throwing her arms out wide and sending layout sliding across the table. I can't believe this. It's such an anticlimax. I really thought your story was going to end with sex in a cabin bunk, or on the deck, or in the middle of the ocean on a dinghy. What actually happened was that I spent the rest of the session in paralysed, panicky suspense, desperately trying to look like I was listening to Catherine's instructions. Arms up, Tiffy. Watch your hair, Tiffy. And simultaneously keep my eyes on the back of the crowd. I did start to wonder if I'd imagined it. What the hell were the chances? I mean, I know the man likes a cruise, but this is a very large country. There are many cruise ships floating around the edge of it. Tell me again, Rachel says, about the look. Oh, I can't explain it, I tell her, laying my forehead down on the pages in front of me. I know that look from when we were together. My stomach twists. It was so inappropriate. I mean, God, his girlfriend, I mean, fiancé. He saw you across a crowded room, semi-unclothed, being gloriously you-like and pissing about with a middle-aged eccentric author. And he remembered why he used to fancy the pants off you, Rachel concludes. That's what happened. That's not... But what did happen? Something, definitely. That look wasn't nothing. I feel a little flutter of anxiety at the base of my ribs. Even after a whole night of thinking about this, I still can't work out how I feel. One minute Justin appearing on a cruise ship and catching my eye seems like the most romantic, fateful moment. And then the next I find myself feeling a bit shivery and sick. I was all jittery on the journey home from the docks too. It's been a while since I've travelled outside London on my own to anywhere other than my parents. Justin had a real thing about how I always ended up on the wrong train, and he was sweet about taking journeys with me just in case. As I waited alone in the darkness of Southampton Station, I felt categorically certain I'd end up taking a train to the Outer Hebrides or something. I reached to check my phone. This meeting with Rachel is only in the diary for half an hour, and then I really do need to edit Catherine's first three chapters. I have one new message. So good to see you yesterday. I was there for work, and when I saw Catherine Rosen, an assistant, on the programme, I thought, hey, that's got to be Tiffy. Only you could laugh your way through someone reading out your measurements. Most girls would hate that. But I guess that's what makes you special. Jay. Kiss, kiss. Hands shaking, I stretch the phone out to show Rachel. She gasps, hands to mouth. He loves you! That man is still in love with you! Calm down, Rachel, I tell her, though my heart is currently making an attempt at a getaway via my throat. I feel as if I'm choking and breathing too much all at the same time. Can you text back and tell him that comments like that are the reason womankind cares so much about their measurements, and that by declaring that most girls would hate that, he is perpetuating the female body image problem and setting women up against one another, which is one of the greatest problems feminism faces to this day? I narrow my eyes at her and she flashes me a big grin. Or you could just say, thanks, come over and show me how special I am all night long. Oh, I don't know why I talk to you. It's me or Martin, she points out, gathering up the layouts. I'll take in these changes. You go get your man back, all right? No, Gertie says immediately. Do not text him that. He is scum of the earth who treated you like shit, tried to isolate you from your friends, and almost certainly cheated on you. He does not deserve a text of this niceness. There is a pause. What made you want to reply with that message, Tiffy? Mo asks, as if he's translating for Gertie. I just wanted to talk to him. My voice is very small. The tiredness is starting to eat away at me. I'm curled up on my beanbag with a hot chocolate, and Mo and Gertie are staring down at me from the sofa, their faces a picture of concern. Actually, Gertie's isn't. She just looks angry. Gertie reads my draft message out again. Hi, Justin. So good to hear from you. I'm just sorry we didn't get to catch up properly, despite being on the same cruise ship. And then two kisses. He did two kisses, I say a little defensively. The kisses are last on my list of things to change about that message, Gertie says. Are you sure you want to start up contact with Justin again at all, Tiffy? You seem a lot better in yourself since you moved out of his flat, Mo says. I wonder if that might not be a coincidence. He sighs when I don't say anything. I know you find it hard to think badly of him, Tiffy, but whatever excuses you can give him for everything else, even you can't ignore the fact that he left you for another woman. I flinch. Sorry, but he did. And even if he's left her, which we don't have any evidence he has, he still went off with her. You can't reason that away or convince yourself you've imagined it, because you've met Patricia. Look back at that Facebook message. Remember how it felt when he turned up with her at the flat. Ugh. Why do people keep saying things I don't want to hear? I miss Rachel. What do you think he's doing, Tiffy? Mo asks. He's pushing so hard all of a sudden. It's making me squirm. Being friendly. Trying to get in touch again. He's not asked to meet up, Mo points out. And the look he gave you was more than friendly by the sounds of it, Gertie says. It's true. It wasn't a, hey, I've missed you so much, I wish we could talk again look. But it was something. It's true I can't ignore the fiancé, but I can't ignore that look either. What did it mean? If he wanted to get back together... Would you? Gertie asks. Would I what? I ask, buying myself time. She doesn't answer. She knows my game. I think about how miserable I've been these last few months, how bleak it was to say goodbye to his flat... How many times I've looked Patricia up on Facebook and cried onto my laptop keyboard until I got a bit worried about electrocution. I was so lucky to have him. Justin was always so fun. Everything was a whirlwind. We'd be flying from country to country, trying everything, staying up until 4 in the morning and climbing onto the roof to watch the sunrise. Yes, we fought a lot, and I made a lot of mistakes in that relationship, but mostly I just felt so lucky to be with him. Without him, I feel lost. I don't know, I say, but a big part of me wants to. Don't worry, Gertie says, standing up smartly and patting me on the head. We won't let you.
Chapter 12. Note from Tiffy.
Hi, Leon.
All right, fine. The truth is, I panic bake. When I'm sad or things are difficult, baking is my go-to. And what of it? I turn my negativity into delicious, calorific goodness. As long as you can't taste traces of misery in the cake mix, I don't think you should be questioning why I've been baking every night this week. Which, as it happens, is because my ex-boyfriend turned up on my cruise ship and gave me the eye and then buggered off. Not my cruise ship. No offence, I wouldn't be sharing a bedroom with you if I was the sort of person who owned a cruise ship. I'd be living in a Scottish castle with technicolour turrets. So now I'm all muddled. He sent me this sweet text about how special I was, but I didn't text back. I wanted to, but my friends talked me out of it. They're annoying and usually right about stuff. Anyway, that's why you've had so much cake. Tiffy. Kiss. Hi, Tiffy. Sorry to hear about your ex. Guessing from your friends' reactions that they don't think he's good for you. Is that what you think? I'm Team X if it means cake. Leon.
Hi, Leon. I don't know. I've not really thought about it like that, actually. My knee-jerk reaction is, yeah, he's good for me, but then I don't know. We were very up and down, one of those couples everyone's always talking about. We've broken up and got back together a few times before. It's easy to remember the happy times, and there were tons of them, and they were awesome, but I guess since we broke up, I've only remembered those. So I know that being with him was fun, but was it good for me? I don't know. Hence the Victoria sandwich with homemade jam. Tiffy. Kiss.
I leave a note on a large ring-bound printout of a book titled Built, My Amazing Journey from Bricklayer to High-End Interior Designer. Be honest. Picked this up off the table as thought it sounded hilariously rubbish. Couldn't put it down. Didn't get to sleep until noon. Is this man your ex? If not, can I marry him? Leon.
Hey, Leon. I'm so glad you enjoyed the book. My beautiful bricklayer-turned-designer is not, in fact, my ex, and yes, he is much more likely to want to marry you than me. I imagine Kay would have opinions on the subject, though.
Tiffy, kiss. Kay says I'm not allowed to marry a beautiful bricklayer-turned-designer. Shame. She says hi.
Good to catch her yesterday. She says I'm making you fat with all the cake. She made me promise to channel my emotional turmoil into healthier options from now on, so I made us carob and date brownies. Sorry, they're totally disgusting. I'm moving this post-it onto Wuthering Heights now, as I need to take Built back to the office. Kiss.
I leave a note on the cupboard above kitchen bin.
When is our bin date again?
Leon.
Is this a joke? I've lived here for 5 weeks. You've lived here for years. How can you be asking me when the bin day is?
But yes, it was yesterday, and we forgot.
Kiss.
Oh, thought so. Can never remember if it's Tuesday or Thursday. It's a days beginning with T thing.
Difficult.
Any news from the ex? You stopped baking. It's okay, freezer stockpile will get me through for a while. But I'm keen for you to have another crisis in, say, mid-May.
Leon. Hey. Total radio silence. He's not even been updating his Twitter or Facebook, so I can't stalk him.
So he's probably still with his fiancée. I mean, why wouldn't he be? All he did was look at me a bit funny.
And I probably completely misread the cruise ship moment. And he's probably a despicable human being like my friend Gertie says he is.
Anyway, I've paid him back all the money I owe him. I now owe the bank a terrifying amount instead.
Thanks for the risotto. It was delicious. You're a really good cook for someone who only ever eats meals at the wrong times of the day.
Tiffy.
Kiss.
I leave a note beside baking tray.
Jesus. Didn't know about the fiancé. Or the money.
Does millionaire shortbread mean you got news? Note from Tiffy beside baking tray, now full of crumbs.
Nothing. He's not even sent a message to say he received the payment. This is totally tragic, but I find myself wishing yesterday that I'd just kept paying a few hundred a month, then in a way we'd still be in touch, and I wouldn't be quite so deep into my overdraft.
Basically, in summary, he hasn't said a word to me since the cruise ship text. I'm officially an idiot. Kiss. I respond. Love makes us all idiots. First time I met Kay, I told her I was a jazz musician. Saxophone. Thought she'd like it. Chileon Hob for you. Leon, kiss.
April. Chapter 13. I think I'm having palpitations. Nobody has had palpitations since the olden days finished, Rachel informs me, taking an unacceptably large sip of the latte the head of editorial bought me. Every so often he feels guilty for Butterfingers not paying me enough and splashes out £2.20 on a coffee to assuage his conscience. This book is killing me, I say. The saturated fat in your lunch is killing you, Rachel prods the banana bread I'm currently munching my way through. Your baking is getting worse. By which I mean better, obviously. Why aren't you getting fatter? I am, but I'm just bigger than you, so you don't notice the difference as much. I stash my new cake weight in bits you won't spot. Like the upper arm, for instance. Or the cheek. I'm getting round of cheeks, don't you think? Edit woman, Rachel says, slapping a hand on the layouts between us. Our weekly catch-ups about Catherine's book soon became daily catch-ups as March slipped by. Now, faced with the terrifying realisation that it is April and our print date is only a couple of months away, they have become daily catch-ups and daily lunches. And when are you getting me the photo of the hats and scarves? Rachel adds. Oh God, the hats and scarves. I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about hats and scarves. There is no agency free to take on making them at such short notice, and Catherine really doesn't have time. Contractually, she doesn't have to make all the samples herself. This is a mistake I will never make again at negotiation stage, so I have no ammunition to make her do it. I tried actual begging, but she told me, not unkindly, that I was embarrassing myself. I gaze mournfully at my banana bread. There is no solution, I say. The end is nigh. The book is going to go to print with no pictures in the hats and scarves chapter. No, it bloody well isn't, Rachel says. For starters, you've not got enough words to fill the space. Edit, and then think of something, and do it fast. Oh, why do I like her again? When I get home, I put the kettle on straight away. It's a cup of tea sort of evening. There's an old note from Leon stuck on the underside of the kettle. They get everywhere, these post-its. Leon's mug is still by the sink, half full of milky coffee. He always drinks it that way, from the same chipped white mug with a cartoon rabbit on the side. Every night that mug will either be on this side of the sink, half drunk, which I guess means he was pushed for time, or washed up on the draining board, which I assume means he managed to get up with the alarm. The flat is pretty homely now. I had to let Leon reclaim some of the space in the living area. Sometime last month he removed half of my cushions and put them in a pile in the hall with a label reading, "I am finally putting my foot down, sorry." But he may have been right that there were a few too many. It was getting quite hard to sit on the sofa. The bed is still the strangest part of this whole flat-sharing thing. For the first month or so, I put my own sheets on and took them off again every morning, and I'd lie on the furthest edge of my left-hand side, my pillow pulled away from his. But now I don't bother alternating the sheets. I only lie on my side anyway. It's really all quite normal. Of course, I still haven't actually met my flatmate, which I acknowledge is technically a bit weird, but we've started leaving each other notes more and more often now. Sometimes I forget we haven't had these conversations in person. I chuck my bag down and collapse on the beanbag while the tea brews. If I'm honest with myself, I'm waiting. I've been waiting for months now, ever since I saw Justin. Surely he's going to get in touch with me. Okay, so I never replied to his text, something I still intermittently hate Gertie and Mo for not letting me do. But he gave me that look on the cruise ship. Obviously, it's now been so long that I've almost entirely forgotten the look itself, and it's just a compilation of different expressions I remember on Justin's face, or maybe more realistically, remember from all his Facebook photos. But still, at the time it felt very... okay, I don't know what it felt. Very something. As more time passes, I found myself thinking about how weird it was that Justin was on that very cruise ship on the one day that Catherine and I were doing the How to Crochet Your Own Clothes Fast show. As much as the thought appeals, it can't have been because he came specially to see me. We were rescheduled at the last minute, so he wouldn't have known I was going to be there. Plus, his text said he was there for work, which is perfectly plausible. He works for an entertainment company that arranges shows for things like cruises and tourist tours of London. I was always a bit hazy on the details, to be honest. It all seemed very logistical and stressful. So if he didn't come on purpose, then doesn't it feel a bit like fate? I grab my tea and wander into the bedroom at a loose end. I don't even want to get back together with Justin, do I? This is the longest we've ever been broken up, and it does feel different from the other times. Maybe because he left me for a woman he then promptly proposed to. It's probably that. In fact, I shouldn't even care whether he's going to get in touch with me. What does that say about me that I'm waiting for a man who most likely cheated on me to give me a call?
It says that you're loyal and trusting,
Mo says when I ring him and ask this very question.
The exact qualities that mean Justin is likely to try and get in touch again.
You think he will too? I realise I'm twitchy, jumpy, hungry for reassurance, which annoys me even more. I start tidying my Gilmore Girls DVDs into the correct order, too jittery to stand still. There's another note jammed between series 1 and 2. I yank it loose and skim over it. I'd been trying to persuade Leon to try actually using our television, offering him my very high-quality DVD collection as a place to start. He was not convinced.
Almost certainly,
Mo says.
That seems to be Justin's way, but are you sure you want him to?
I'd like him to talk to me, or at least acknowledge me. I don't know where his head is at. He seemed so mad at me about the flat, but then that message after I saw him on the cruise ship was really sweet, so I don't know. I want him to call. Ugh. I clench my eyes shut. Why is that?
Maybe you spent a lot of time being told you couldn't manage without him,
Mo says gently.
That would explain why you want him back, even when you don't want him.
I flounder around looking for a change of subject. The latest episode of Sherlock? The new assistant at work? But I find I don't even have the energy to be diverting. Mo waits quietly.
It's true, though. Isn't it? I mean, have you thought about dating anyone else?
I could date someone else, I protest. He sighs.
How did that look on the cruise ship really make you feel, Tiffy?
I don't know. It was ages ago now. I guess it was kind of sexy and nice to be wanted.
You weren't afraid?
What?
Did you feel afraid? Did the look make you feel smaller?
I frown. Mo, give it a rest. It was just a look. He definitely wasn't trying to scare me. Besides, I rang you to talk about whether he'll ever call me. And thanks, you made me feel a bit better about that, so let's draw the line there. For a long while, there's silence at the other end of the phone. I'm a little shaken, despite myself.
That relationship took its toll on you, Tiffy,
Mo says gently.
He made you miserable.
I shake my head. I mean, I know me and Justin argued, but we always made up, and things only got more romantic after a fight, so it didn't really count. It wasn't like when other couples argued. It was all just part of the beautiful, crazy roller coaster that was our relationship.
It'll all sink in eventually, Tiff,
Mo says.
When it does, you just get on the phone to me, okay?
I nod, not really sure what I'm agreeing to. From my vantage point, I've just spotted the perfect distraction from how I'm feeling right now. The bag of scarves under Leon's bed. The one I found on my first night here, which convinced me that Leon was probably some kind of serial killer. There's a note on them which I'm sure wasn't there when I looked at them before. It says, "For charity shop." "Thanks, Mo," I say on the phone. "See you Sunday for coffee." I hang up, already looking around for a pen. "Hey, okay, sorry for snooping under our bed. I get that that's definitely unacceptable. But these scarves are incredible. As in, designer incredible. And I know we've never talked about this or anything, but I'm guessing that if you're letting a random stranger, me, sleep in your bed, then you're doing it because you're short of cash, not because you're a really nice man who feels bad about how hard it is to get a cheap flat in London. So while I'm all for giving old clothes to charity shops, after all, I buy most of my possessions from charity shops, people like me need people like you, I think you should consider selling these scarves. You'd probably get around £200 a pop. If you feel like giving one 90% off to your lovely flatmate, I won't object. Tiffy. P.S. Where did you get them all from, by the way, if you don't mind me asking?
Chapter 14. Arms out wide, legs akimbo. A stern-looking prison guard frisks me very enthusiastically. Suspect I fit her profile of person who may bring drugs or weapons into visiting hall. Imagine her flicking through her mental checklist. Gender, male. Race, indeterminate, but a bit browner than would be preferable. Age, young enough not to know better. Appearance, scruffy. Try to smile in a non-threatening, good citizen sort of way. Probably comes across as cocky on reflection. Begin to feel slightly queasy. The reality of this place seeping in despite the efforts I have made to pointedly ignore rows of barbed wire on top of thick steel fences, windowless buildings, aggressive signs about consequences of smuggling drugs into prisons, despite having done this at least once a month since November. The walk from security to the visiting hall is perhaps the worst part. It involves a maze of concrete and barbed wire, and all the way you are ferried by different prison guards, taking their keychains from their hips for gates and doors that need locking behind you before you can even take a step towards the next one. It's a beautiful spring day. The sky is just visible above the wires, tauntingly blue. Visiting hall is better. Kids toddle between tables or get lifted overhead, squealing by muscly dads. Prisoners wear bright coloured bibs to differentiate them from the rest of us. Men in high-vis orange inch closer to visiting girlfriends than they're strictly allowed to be, fingers wound tight. There's more emotion here than at an airport arrivals lounge. Love Actually was missing a trick. Sit at a assigned table. Wait. When they bring Richie in, my stomach does a peculiar lurch, like it's trying to turn inside out. He looks tired and unwashed, cheeks hollow, head hastily shaved. He's in his only pair of jeans. Won't have wanted me to see him in the prison-issue joggers, but they're too loose around the waist now. Hate it. Hate it. Hate it. I get up and smile, stretching my arms out for a hug. Wait for him to come to me. Can't leave allocated area. Prison guards line the walls, watching closely, expressionless. Richie slapping me on the back. All right, brother. You're looking good. Me. You too. Richie says, liar, I look like shit warmed up. Water's been knocked out after some scene on E-Wing. No idea when it'll be back on, but until then, I wouldn't recommend trying to use the toilets. Noted. How you doing? Peachy, have you heard anything from Sal? Thought I could avoid that topic for at least 1 minute. Yeah, he's sorry about those papers holding up the appeal, Richie. He's working on it. Richie's face closes up. I can't keep waiting, Lee. You want me to try and find someone new? I'll do it. Glum silence. Richie knows as well as I do that this'll probably slow things down even further. Did he get the footage from the Aldi camera? Did he even request the footage from the Aldi camera is the question. I'm starting to doubt it, even though he told me he did. Rub back of neck. Look down at shoes, wish harder than ever that Richie and I were anywhere but here. Not yet. That's the key, man, I'm telling you. That camera in Aldi will show them. They'll see it's not me. Wish that was true. How high res is the footage, though? How likely is it that it'll be clear enough to counteract the witness identification? We talk about the appeal case for almost a full hour. Just can't get him off the topic. Forensics, overlooked evidence, always the CCTV. Hope, hope, hope. Leave with shaky knees, take a cab to the station. Need sugar. Have some tiffin tiffy made in bag. Eat about 3,000 calories of it as the train rolls through the countryside. Flat field after flat field taking me away from my brother and back to the place where everyone's forgotten him. Find bin bag of scarves in centre of bedroom when I get home, with Tiffy's note pasted on its side. Mr. Pryor makes £200 scarves. Doesn't even take him very long. Ah, think of all the times I turned down his offer of new scarf, hat, glove or tea cosy. Could have been a billionaire by now. I leave a note on bedroom door. Hi, Tiffy. Thank you for telling me about the scarves. Yes, need the money. We'll sell. Can you recommend where or how? Gentleman at work knits them. He's basically giving them away to anyone or everyone who will take them. Or else I'd feel bad taking the money. Leon.
Hey, oh, definitely you should sell these through Etsy or Preloved. They'll have tons of customers who would love these scarves. Odd question, but might this gentleman at your work be interested in crocheting for commission? Tiffy, kiss. No idea what that means. By the way, take your fave scarf, we'll put rest on interweb tonight. Leon. Note fallen on floor by bedroom door. Quite hard to track down. Morning. As in, I'm working on a book called Crochet Your Way. I know, it's one of my best titles, I have to say. And we need someone to make us 4 scarves and 8 hats very, very fast so we can photograph them to include in the book. He'd have to follow my author's brief on colour and stitch, etc. I can pay him, but not a lot. Can you give me his contact details? I'm really desperate and he's obviously crazily talented. Oh my God, I'm going to be wearing this scarf all the time. I don't care if it's technically springtime. I love it. Thank you. Tiffy, kiss. I put my response on the bedroom door. Can't see why this wouldn't work. Though might need to run it by matron. Write me a letter and we'll give it to her. Then to gentleman knitter if she gives the okay. If you're wearing that scarf all the time, can you dispose of the 500 scarves currently occupying your side of the wardrobe? Other news. First scarf just sold for £235. Mad. It's not even nice. Leon. I find this note from Tiffy on kitchen breakfast bar beside unsealed envelope. Hey, my side is the key part of that sentence, Leon. My side, and I want to fill it with scarves. The letter is here. Let me know if you think it needs changing at all. At some point, we may need to do a bit of a tidy of our notes to one another, by the way. The flat is starting to look like a scene from A Beautiful Mind. Tiffy, kiss. I pass Tiffy's letter to Matron, who gives me the all clear to offer Mr. Pryor the opportunity to knit for Tiffy's book, or crochet. I'm extremely unclear on the difference. No doubt Tiffy will write me a long note at some point with detailed explanation unprompted. She loves a lengthy explanation. Why use one clause when you could use 5? Strange, ridiculous, hilarious woman. One night later, and Mr. Pryor's got 2 hats done already. They look hat-like and woolly, so I'm assuming all is as it should be. Only downside to this arrangement is now Mr. Pryor is fascinated with Tiffy. So, she's a book editor? Yes. What an interest and profession. A pause. And she lives with you? Mm-hmm. How interesting. Look at him sideways while writing his notes. He blinks back at me, beady-eyed and innocent. I just didn't imagine you'd like living with another person. You like your independence so much. Isn't that why you didn't want to move in with Kay? Must stop talking to patients about personal life. It's different. I don't have to see Tiffy. We just leave each other notes, really. Mr. Pryor nods thoughtfully. The art of letter writing. A profoundly intimate thing, a letter, isn't it? I stare at him suspiciously. Not sure what he's getting at here. I say, it's post-its on the fridge, Mr. Pryor, not hand-delivered letters on scented paper. Oh, yes, I'm sure you're right. Absolutely, post-its. No art in that, I'm sure. Next night, and even Holly has heard about Tiffy. Amazing how uninteresting news travels so fast between wards when significant proportion of people in building are bedbound. Holly says, is she pretty? I don't know, Holly. Does it matter? Holly pauses, thoughtful. Is she nice? Me, after a moment's thought. Yes, she's nice. Bit nosy and strange, but nice. What does it mean that she's your flatmate? Flatmate means she shares my flat. We live there together. Holly's eyes widen. Like boyfriend and girlfriend? No, she's not my girlfriend. She's a friend. So you sleep in different rooms? I get bleep before I have to answer that one, thankfully.
May, Chapter 15. As I peel the post-its and tape scraps of paper off cupboard doors, tables, walls, and in one case the bin lid, I find myself grinning. It was a weird way to get to know Leon, writing all these notes over the last few months, and it sort of happened without me noticing. One minute I was scribbling him a quick note about leftovers, the next I was in a full-on day-to-day correspondence. Though as I follow the trail of heart to heart along the back of the sofa, I can't help noticing that I generally write about 5 times as many words as Leon does, and that my post-its are a lot more personal and revealing than his. It's kind of strange reading it all back. You can see how dodgy my memory is, for starters. Like in one of the notes, I mentioned how super awkward it was that I'd forgotten to pass on Rachel's birthday party invite to Justin last year. But I remember now, I did invite him. We ended up having a huge fight about whether I could go. Justin always said my memory was terrible. It's very annoying to find written evidence that he's right. It's 5:30 now. I finished work early because everyone's out of the office for a goodbye party that I can't afford to go to, so I made an executive decision to go home in the absence of any actual executives to make the decision for me. I'm sure it's what they would have wanted. I thought I might actually catch Leon tonight as I got back at around 5 p.m. It felt a bit strange. I'm not really allowed to come home early and bump into him, according to the official terms of our agreement. I knew when I signed up for this that we wouldn't be in the flat at the same time. That was why it was such a good idea. But I didn't realise that we would literally never meet. Like, ever, at all, for 4 whole months. I did think about spending this hour at the coffee place around the corner, but then I thought, it is starting to get a bit weird being friends but not having actually met. And it does feel like that, like we're friends. I don't think it could be otherwise, the way we're in each other's space all the time. I know exactly how he likes his eggs fried, though I've never actually seen him eat one. There's always tons of runny yolk left over the plate. I could describe his dress sense pretty accurately, even though I've never seen him in any of the clothes drying on the clothes horse in the living room. And weirdest of all, I know what he smells like. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't meet. It wouldn't change the terms of how we live here. It would just mean I would actually recognise my flatmate if I saw him walking down the street. The phone rings, which is odd because I wasn't aware we had a phone. At first I go for my mobile, but my ringtone is a jingly happy tune from right down the list of those available from Samsung, not the retro ring ring that's currently singing out from somewhere invisible in the living room. I eventually track down a landline on the kitchen counter, under one of Mr. Pryor's scarves, and a string of notes about whether or not Leon used up all the butter. He totally did. A landline? Who knew? I thought landlines were just relics you paid for in order to get broadband. Hello? I try tentatively.
Oh, hey,
says the guy at the other end. He sounds surprised. Presumably I'm more female than he had expected, and has a weird accent, kind of half Irish, half Londoner. I can't do the accent, you'll just have to imagine. It's Tiffy, I offer. Leon's flatmate.
Hey, hi!
He seems to have been greatly cheered by this fact.
And don't you mean bedmate?
We prefer flatmate, I say, wincing.
Fair play,
he says, and somehow I can sort of hear that he's grinning.
Well, nice to meet you, Tiffy. I'm Richie, Leon's brother.
Pleased to meet you too, Richie. I didn't know Leon had a brother, but then I suppose there are probably an enormous number of things I don't know about Leon, even if I do know what he's reading before bed at the moment. The bell jar, very slowly. You just miss Leon, I guess. I got in 30 minutes ago and he was already gone.
The man works too hard,
Richie says.
I didn't realise it was 5:30 already. What's your tap-in, tap-out time?
6, usually, but I got out of work early, I say. You could try him on his mobile?
Ah, now you see, Tiffy, I can't do that.
I frown. You can't call his mobile?
To be honest with you, it's a bit of a long story. Richie pauses. Short version is, I'm in a high-security prison and the only phone number I've managed to get set up for me to call is Leon's home line. Mobiles cost twice as much to call too, and I earn about £14 a week in my job cleaning the wing, which, by the way, I had to pay someone to get me, so that doesn't get me very far.
I feel a little shell-shocked. Shit, I say. That's awful. Are you all right? It just comes out. It's almost certainly not the right thing to say in the circumstance, but there we are. That's what I'm thinking, and that's what comes out of my mouth. To my surprise, and maybe to his too, Richie starts laughing.
I'm all right,
he says after a moment.
Cheers, though. It's been 7 months now. I guess I'm... what is it Leon calls it? Acclimatising. Learning how to live as well as just get through each minute.
I nod. Well, that's something at least. How is it? On a scale of, you know, Alcatraz to the Hilton. He laughs again.
Definitely somewhere on that scale, yeah. Whereabouts depends on how I'm feeling day to day. But I'm pretty lucky compared to lots of people, let me tell you that. I have my own cell now and I can see visitors twice a month.
It doesn't seem like he's lucky from where I'm standing. I don't want to keep you on the phone if it's costing you. Did you have a message for Leon? There's a rattling sort of silence at the other end, just the sound of echoing background noise.
Aren't you going to ask me what I'm in for, Tiffy?
No, I say, taken aback. Do you want to tell me?
Yeah, a bit, but normally people ask.
I shrug. It's not my place to judge. You're Leon's brother and you rang to talk to him. And anyway, we were talking about how horrible prison is, and that's true regardless of what you did. Everyone knows prison doesn't work, right?
Right. I mean, do they?
Oh, sure. More silence.
I'm in for armed robbery, but I didn't do it.
God, I'm sorry. This is really shit, then.
Pretty much, yeah.
Richie says. He waits, and then he asks,
do you believe me?
I don't even know you. Why does it matter?
I don't know. It just does.
Well, I need some other facts before I say I believe you. It wouldn't mean much otherwise, would it?
That's my message for Leon, then. Tell him I'd like him to give you the facts so you can tell me if you believe me.
Hang on. I reach for a pad of post-its and a pen. Hi, Leon, I say, reading as I write. This is a message from Richie. He says,
I'd like Tiffy to know what happened to me. I want her to believe I didn't do it. She seems like a very nice lady, and I bet she's pretty to boot. You can just tell, man, she's got that kind of voice. Deep and sexy, you know the...
I'm laughing. I'm not writing that.
How far did you get?
Sexy, I admit, and Richie laughs.
All right, you can sign the note off now. But leave that last bit, if you don't mind. It'll make Leon smile.
I shake my head, but I'm smiling too. Fine, I'll leave it. It was good to meet you, Richie.
You too, Tiffy. You look after my brother for me, all right?
I pause, surprised at the request. For starters, it seems like Richie's the one who needs looking after, and for seconds, I'm not really best placed for looking after any of the Toomey family, given that I've never met a single one of them. But by the time I open my mouth to respond, Richie's hung up the phone, and all I can hear is the dial tone.
Chapter 16. Can't help laughing. This is typical. He's trying to charm his way into the affections of my flatmate, even from a prison yard. Kay leans over my shoulder, reading the note. Richie is still his old self, I see. I stiffen. She feels it and tenses too, but doesn't backtrack or say sorry. He's trying to keep things light, keep everyone laughing. It's Richie's way. Well, is Tiffy on the market? She's a human, not a cow, Kay. You're so principled, Leon. It was an expression, on the market. You know I'm not actually trying to sell the poor girl to Richie. There's something else wrong with that sentence, but I'm too tired to trace it. I say, she's single, but in love with her ex still. Really? Can't fathom why she'd care. Whenever I mention Tiffy, she switches off or gets grumpy. This is the first time we've been in my flat for months, actually. Kay has the morning off work, so came to see me for Brinner before bed. She got a bit prickly about the notes stuck everywhere for some reason. I say, X seems average. Far inferior to bricklayer turned. Kay rolls eyes. Will you stop talking about that bloody bricklayer book? She wouldn't be so judgmental if she'd read it. A few weeks on, and it's the sort of sunny day that normally only happens abroad. England is unaccustomed to such warmth, especially when it strikes so suddenly. It's only June, barely summer yet. Commuters hurry around corners, heads still down as if it's raining, backs of pale blue shirts stained dark with V's of sweat. Teenage boys whip off T-shirts until there are stark white limbs and chests and gawky sticking out elbows all over the place. Can barely move without being confronted with sunburnt skin and or unpleasant body heat emanating from man in suit. I'm on my way back from visit to Imperial War Museum research room, following a final lead on the hunt for Johnny White. In my backpack, I have a list of 8 names and addresses. Addresses were gathered through endless record office riffling, contacting relatives, and online stalking. So not exactly foolproof, but it's a start. Or rather, 8 starts. Mr. Pryor gave me plenty to bulk out my research in the end. Get the man talking and he remembers a lot more than he claims to. Every man on list is called Johnny White. Unsure where to start. Pick favourite Johnny? Nearest Johnny. Get out phone and text Tiffy. Filled her in on search for Mr. Pryor's Johnny White last month. Was after a lengthy letter from her about ups and downs of book about crochet. I was obviously in sharing sort of mood. It's peculiar. Like Tiffy's compulsive oversharing is contagious. Always feel slightly embarrassed when I get to the hospice and remember whatever I ended up revealing in that evening's scribbled note written with coffee before heading to the door. My text reads, "Hi, got 8 Johnnies to choose from. How to pick where to start? Leon." Response comes 5 minutes or so later. She's working on the crazy crochet author's book full time and it appears her concentration is low. I'm not surprised. Crochet is weird and boring. Even tried reading some of the manuscript when she left on the coffee table to check was not like bricklayer book, but no. It's just a book of detailed crochet instructions with end results that look very difficult to achieve. Her response comes in. "That's easy. Eeny, meeny, miny, emo, catch a tiger by its toe. Kiss, kiss." And then, 2 seconds later, "Eeny, meeny, miny, mo." Autocorrect. "I don't think you gain much by getting any small emos involved. Kiss, kiss." Peculiar woman. Nonetheless, dutifully pause in patch of shade under bus stop to get out lists of names and do eeny, meeny. Land on Johnny White, obviously. It's the one who lives up near Birmingham. Text Tiffy. "Good choice. Can visit this one when next visiting Richie. He's in Birmingham area. Thanks. Leon." A few minutes of silence. Walk through busy, sweaty London as it basks in the heat. Sunglasses turned up to the sky. I'm knackered. Should have been in bed hours ago. But I spend so little actual daylight time out here in the open air these days, I miss the feel of sun on my skin. Consider idly whether I might be vitamin D deficient. Then thoughts shift. And I'm wondering how much open air time Richie got this week. According to government, he should be let outside for 30 minutes a day. That rarely happens. Prison guards are low on numbers. Time unlocked is even more limited than usual. Another text comes in from Tiffy. "Did you get my note about Richie, by the way?